This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the lasting impacts of wildfire on the Central Coast.
If we do lose 9 or 10 condors out of the 100 that we had to begin with, you know, that's a 10% reduction almost overnight.
And we'll get a look at the local aviation industry.
The need to move people and products is as old as humanity. You know, we used to do it with a cart and a horse, and now we do it with airplanes.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 12th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll start with some election coverage. California voters are deciding on Proposition 17. It's a ballot measure which, if passed, would restore voting rights to people on parole, the period of state supervision that occurs after inmates leave prison. KQED's politics reporter Guy Moserati has more on the history that got us here.
Voting rights was a hot topic at California's 1849 Constitutional Convention. Delegates in Monterey debated whether to allow former Mexican citizens, American Indians, and recently arrived gold miners to vote in the new state. But they spent little time debating the voting rights of former inmates. The delegates quietly passed a constitutional amendment banning people convicted of infamous crimes from voting. But what was an infamous crime?
Infamy is an incredibly complicated concept even back then.
That's Pippa Holloway, professor of history at the University of Richmond, whose research has focused on felony disenfranchisement.
Infamy was such a flexible term, a poorly misunderstood term, a term that could be kind of manipulated in various ways statutorily.
In California, infamy usually meant felony, but the law wasn't very clear. Fast forward to 1966, when the state Supreme Court applied a new interpretation, that infamous crimes should be those that literally affect the election, that people convicted of assault or abuse don't threaten the ballot box.
That's kind of a narrow, although I think really distinctly modern interpretation of what infamy means.
But that interpretation didn't last. In 1974, California voters approved Proposition 10, which allowed former inmates to vote after their parole term was completed. It also removed the vague term infamous crime and instead stripped voting rights for anyone convicted of a felony. Again, Pippa Holloway.
There's a gradual kind of a rejection of these old ideas about infamy and morality, and more of an understanding that a felony is a felony, the worst of the worst are felons, and that there's a fairly clear line between the length of your incarceration and the kind of moral or social impact of your crime.
Stripping voting rights for felony convictions while California's incarceration rates were going up disproportionately disenfranchised Black and Latino Californians. It's why State Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, a Democrat from Sacramento, has referred to the state's current ban on parolee voting as a modern-day poll tax.
If you look at their percentage of people who are on parole and can't vote, you know, they are people of color.
McCarty wrote Proposition 17 to restore the right to vote to parolees. Opponents like North State Senator Jim Nielsen say California's parole population has shrunk and now contains only serious offenders.
They then, with the franchise to vote, they become more full participant in society. Society that they've already shown their disdain for.
Proposition 17 is a fairly limited proposal. Unlike Maine and Vermont, which never strip inmates of their right to vote, California would only restore voting rights to eligible voters on parole if Prop 17 passes, which currently would affect about 40,000 people.
That was KQED's politics reporter Guy Moserati reporting. Among the dozen ballot measures this election, California voters are also deciding on Proposition 15. As CAP Radio's Chris Nichols reports, the initiative would raise taxes on big businesses while providing new revenue for schools and local governments.
Prop 15 is expected to raise as much as $12 billion every year for local schools, community colleges, cities, and counties. It would do this by removing a property tax protection for big businesses, one that was granted in the 1970s under Proposition 13. The protection for homeowners would remain. Here's Yes on 15 spokesperson Alex Stack.
We're talking about Hollywood movie studios, companies in Silicon Valley like IBM and Intel, which have been around for decades, haven't changed ownership, are still paying property taxes based on assessments from the 1960s and 70s.
Under Prop 15, these large corporations would have to pay property tax based on current market value. Right now, they pay a much lower rate based on the original purchase price. But Rob Lapsley of the California Business Roundtable says the tax hike would harm not just big companies, but small ones too. Large commercial properties will pass the increase on to smaller tenants, such as restaurants, Lapsley says, in the form of higher rents and fees.
Ultimately, everybody pays this tax, but the most importantly, the small business owner is going to get hit exactly at the wrong time in this economic crisis.
The tax increase would kick in 2022 for some properties, but not until 3 years later for those where half or more of the tenants are small businesses. In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
Looking at the race to represent San Luis Obispo and parts of Monterey County in the state Senate, an environmentalist with nearly 20 years of public service experience, John Laird, is vying for termed-out Bill Monning's state Senate seat. Running against him is Republican Vicki Norden, a former realtor and pastor who says she's fighting for small businesses and families. Contributor Sean Flannelly reports.
John Laird got his start on the Santa Cruz City Council in 1981. And was elected mayor in 1983, becoming one of the first openly gay mayors in the United States. Laird was elected as a state assembly member in 2002, representing a portion of San Jose, and served two terms. It was during this time that he and assembly member Tim Leslie authored the Sierra Nevada Conservancy Act. The bill established the eponymous agency, which is meant to provide environmental, economic, and social support for the Sierra Nevada region. He was also one of 54 co-authors on Assembly Bill 32, or the California Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. The bill put greenhouse gas standards in place for the Air Resources Board to adhere to. Laird is endorsed by the incumbent Democrat Bill Monning, who is serving his last eligible term in office.
If it is John, we've established a good working rapport, a history of working together, and so I think that would benefit the constituents of the 17th Senate District for the continuity of some of that work.
Laird previously ran for state Senate and lost in the 15th District. He was then appointed Secretary for Natural Resources under Governor Jerry Brown. As Secretary, Laird worked on the California Water Action Plan that established priorities for sustainably managing California's water. The Democratic candidate also advocated for the controversial California Water Fix, that would have updated the state's water system by drilling tunnels into the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and diverting water south. Governor Newsom backed away from the plan last year. Laird's opponent, Republican Vicki Norden, is a relative political newcomer. She ran for state assembly in 2018 in the 29th District, representing parts of Monterey, Santa Cruz, and Santa Clara counties. She was defeated by incumbent Democrat Mark Stone. Norden is endorsed by state Senate Minority Leader Shannon Grove. Grove says she's not at all concerned by the political experience gap between the candidates, and that Norden understands what her constituents need.
Vicki's qualified because she's not going to vote for gas tax increases. Vicki's qualified because she's not going to vote for property tax increases. She realizes how expensive it is to live in this state. Vicki's qualified because she'll do everything she can to repeal AB 5, which stops independent contractors and freelancers.
Norden says she's running for the small businesses and families in the district that are overtaxed and overregulated. Norden notably opposes Proposition 15, which would increase taxes on high-earning factories, stores, and industrial real estate. Norden also supports a repeal of the controversial Assembly Bill 5, which created new definitions for who could be considered an independent contractor. The bill requires businesses like Lyft and Uber to treat their contractors like employees, providing a minimum wage and benefits. The candidate previously served as court-appointed special advocate for children. These are community volunteers who observe and make recommendations on behalf of abused or neglected children. In the primary election in March, Laird received 44.4% of the vote, while Norden received 31.5%. Laird has raised over $1 million in contributions from over 1,200 donors, according to CalAccess data, and Norden has raised just over $127,000 from 339 contributors. Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Sean Flannelly.
It's been several months since protests against racial injustice and police brutality broke out across the country. California has since approved new laws, which Democratic leaders say will address some of those issues, including a measure to study the impacts of slavery and recommend reparations for African Americans. Assemblywoman Shirley Weber chairs the California Black Legislative Caucus. She spoke with Cap Radio's Nicole Nixon about which laws she believes can help address systemic racism.
If you say which one's going to really affect African Americans the most, it probably will be the reparations bill. It should really inform all of California about just how pervasive racism has been and is in most societies. When it's instituted, it doesn't just quickly go away. It's self-embedded in so many aspects of that culture that if you don't change dramatically in a very aggressive and affirmative way, you end up wondering why you're doing certain things because you're still lingering from the effects of it.
Where should this reparations task force start? And what other forms of reparations could there be besides just like cash payments?
Well, hopefully it won't just be cash payments because I look at the situation when you're dealing with something that's 400 years old, it's hard to say we can give you $20,000 and make you well. I mean, that is not likely to happen. I mean, because of the issues that we face. There's been quite a bit of work already done on reparations. We hope that the commission will build on that and utilize that as a foundation to ask critical questions like, what is the damage that's been done and how do we have it remedy what is taking place? And so my assumption is that it will begin by looking at the laws that we've passed. California was not, quote unquote, a slave state, yet it did a number of things to support slavery. It did a number of things to treat African Americans as second class citizens in the state. And the effect that had on the citizenry and its opportunities in terms of economic development, business, education, those kinds of things we hope will be revealed as we look at the legislation that was passed and the various practices that existed in California.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is what would you say or what do you say to opponents of these measures who say that they're not slave owners, their families, their ancestors may not have been slave owners, but as taxpayers, they will probably be paying into some kind of fund?
They're absolutely correct. They are not slaveholders, but they still benefited from it and they continue to benefit from it because if you take land or you own land and you were part of an insurance company that basically insured slaves and made sure that the slave system stayed in place. While you didn't own a slave and you may not have been around at that time because that was so long ago, you still have access to that wealth. You still have access to the attitude that society has about that wealth and you still prosper from it. And so there's no question that while those who are walking around now can say, well, I wasn't a slaveholder. Why am I having to do this? It's because you live on the benefits of what slavery produced, and you see the benefits every day.
I want to talk about your priorities for next year. Is there anything that didn't make it through? I know several of the police reform bills didn't. Anything you're pushing in particular next year?
We will be pushing the decertification bill. Now, that one was very important and should have gotten through. And decertification is such a simple concept. Because almost every profession wants to get rid of the people who are giving them a bad reputation. And yet our state doesn't have adequate process and procedures to accomplish that. While California is very progressive in some ways, it is very regressive in those areas. And so that bill is important. There was another bill that didn't get through, which was the bill to duty to intervene, that if officers are part of something that is illegal, that's against their protocol, that they have a responsibility to engage. And I think that's what people saw in looking at what was happening with George Floyd, is that these other people sat around, other officers, and watched it. And no one said, hey, that's enough, stop. And so I'm disappointed that it didn't get further, but I'm committed to make sure that it gets out this coming year.
Well, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you and have a good day.
Wildfires can have a lasting impact on the natural environment. New life can sprout from the ashes, but some things are lost forever. As KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports, to understand the long-term impacts on the Central Coast, here are three examples: a beloved park, almost extinct birds, and some famous trees.
In early September, I visited Big Basin Redwood State Park in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The park is still off limits to the public, but some journalists were allowed in to see what the CZU Lightning Complex had done to this park. At that time, the nearby wildfire had not been fully contained, and the smoke was still thick in the air. It was eerily quiet, except for a lone crow squawking in the distance. Burnt leaves crunched under your shoes as you walked, and as far as your eyes could see were charred redwoods.
The lengths of the flame when the fire came through here might have been higher than 300 feet.
That's Joanne Kabavis, a senior environmental scientist for California State Parks.
That has scorched the sides of these trees and reached up into the canopy.
She's standing close to where the park's headquarters once stood. Built in the 1930s, all that's left now is the stone chimney. It's one of over 75 structures damaged or destroyed.
Many of the trees have fallen down, and that is because even the redwoods that are notorious for being able to both resist and be resilient from impact can't resist the fire eating away at some of the wood that's their means of support.
Kabavis isn't worried, though, about the long-term impacts of this blaze on the redwoods. She says they are one of the few evergreens that can sprout throughout the trunk and base.
The tree can die, but all of its identical twins are still alive and can produce new stems from the same root system.
Further south, in Big Sur, there isn't this much optimism. The Dolan fire isn't contained yet, but the consequences on this region's California condor population is already very apparent. Of all the condors the Ventana Wildlife Society tracks, 2 of 8 chicks perished in the fire, and 9 free-flying condors remain missing. Kelly Sorensen is the Society's executive director.
If we do lose 9 or 10 condors out of the 100 that we had to begin with, you know, that's a 10% reduction almost overnight.
In 1982, the California condor population was at an all-time low of just 22 birds. It's taken captive breeding programs and decades of work to bring them back from extinction. The Dolan fire was the worst-case scenario for these birds. The fire started near their sanctuary at night, says Sorensen, and because condors are diurnal, meaning they don't fly at night, they were unable to escape. The loss to those who have cared for these missing birds is immense.
Well, it's hard not to be attached to our elder, Condor 167, named Kingpin, 23-year-old male. Literally has been out in the wild since we have been releasing condors.
North of Big Sur is what Brian Flores calls the crown jewel of the Monterey County Park System, Toro Park. About 3/4 of this over 4,000-acre open space was scorched in the river fire. The damage is the worst on the ridges and peaks.
So trees, shrubs, everything's gone. It looks like the surface of the moon.
I connected with Flores over Zoom soon after the park had announced its indefinite closure. He hiked up to one of the ridges so he could give me a panoramic view of the damage. Birds are chirping in the background, and he told me some turkey vultures were keeping an eye on him.
I can basically see all the way down to the front gate from this area, and, breaks my heart, but it's all black.
Toro Park, which can see a few thousand visitors on a slow day, is expected to remain closed into next year because it's just too dangerous for the public to visit.
Lots of hazard trees. Trees that burned and are just barely hanging on. And Cal Fire has been great about marking those trees with tape that actually says killer tree.
Also, any extra foot or bicycle traffic can exacerbate soil erosion and damage plants that are trying to make their way back. But out of the ash comes a wish list. Flores says they're rebuilding with a blank slate. New trails can be developed in places where it might not have been possible before because the brush was once too dense. And it's going to be a community effort. He gets emotional talking to me about it.
Sorry, I'm getting a little choked up talking about the park. But we want people just to have that connection. And I think it's just going to be such a stronger connection for the community once they help us, rebuild this jewel.
I'm Michelle Loxton. This is KEZU News.
Correspondent Tom Wilmer spoke with then San Luis Obispo County Airport Director Kevin Boomen about COVID-19 sanitation initiatives, reduced daily flights, and Boomen's new position as the first Chief Commercial Officer at San Francisco International Airport.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the San Luis Obispo County Airport in San Luis. And we're here with Kevin Boomen.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. So here we are. COVID-19 continues. Strange days.
It has been an unusual year, to say the least.
So tell us the state of the state of travel by air and what you guys have learned, how it's evolved, your safety protocols.
So as far as our operation of the passenger terminal, we, like many businesses, had to make changes in how we were doing our maintenance routines for custodial services and different practices within the building for cleaning. We were adapting that early after all this started because, you know, air travel and airports were not allowed to close. We were required to remain open, and the airlines continued to serve the market, so there was a very, very small amount of demand early in this. We adapted the operation pretty quickly. We're now going through what's called the Global Biorisk Advisory Council certification process.
And what does that look
at? And so the GBOC, the Global Biorisk Advisory Council, is an industry group that looks at facility hygiene and industrial hygiene across many industries and does an audit process where they look at your procedures, everything from the type of cleaning products you're using to how they're being applied, how you're training your staff, and then the efficacy of that process. Does it work? Are you actually achieving a level of sanitation in your cleaning? And then ongoing reporting. So we're hopeful to see that initial application and certification process completed here this fall. And there's airports around the country that are going through this as well. It's not a required process to go through, but certainly the kind of the top of the best practice. As far as our activity levels, in August, we were down about 56% year over year from August of last year.
Have you had cutbacks in the number of flights per day?
We do have fewer flights per day. We're about half of our prior schedule. So,
have you stopped serving some gateways?
We currently have service suspended on Las Vegas, San Diego, and Portland, which never actually initiated service back earlier this summer. Portland and San Diego right now are scheduled to start in March of 2021, and Las Vegas at this point doesn't have a restart date. So we're hopeful that they will all come back. And I think, you know, our market has shown that with the service we've had, albeit limited, we have filled those seats as we typically do. So far, so good. We're looking at September, we'll probably be about 50% of year prior. But we're not seeing much growth going forward. When we look at the forecasted seats in the market through the end of the year, it's going to be about the same or even a little less, depending on which period you look at. And of course, with the looming significant layoffs at the airlines.
Right now, real time in San Francisco.
Yeah, we're looking at that closely. There hasn't been anything revealed specifically to our airport in terms of impacts, but
you're talking about laying off, 16,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
That has to affect.
And it's United and American.
Right.
You know, all the carriers are looking at having to make some additional cuts.
Doesn't that mean you're going to follow, you have to reduce the number of flights because you don't have the flight attendants and
on many routes? Yes, on the spoke routes like ours, I would say likely. They have not revealed any major schedule changes as of yet,
but possibility
in the next few days. I think we're going to see more there.
As you know, I still travel. I'm out of here, I think Monday, to Arkansas. So it's always a little think twice when you fly. But
you know, the onboard sanitation on the aircraft is really incredible what the airlines have done, you know, both between every flight as well as the deep cleaning when the aircraft are on the ground at night. There's just such a higher level of detail involved in that now than has ever been there. I think that's something that this industry is going to a large part retain post-COVID. I think the airlines are seeing that really matters to the customer, certainly at this moment. But I think there will be some long-lasting changes in the industry from this.
Going forward, Kevin Boomen, County Airport Director, you're leaving us. What happened?
I am. Next week is my last week here at the airport, and I was offered the position at San Francisco International Airport as the Chief Commercial Officer.
What does that mean?
That's an interesting job in the airport space, something you see more commonly at the larger airports. It is essentially the executive in charge of the airport's revenue side of the business. So, you know, airports are enterprise forms of government. We operate based on revenue that we generate with the aviation activity and the non-aviation activity at the airport. And so this position will be in charge of the revenue for the airport, everything from, you know, working with food, beverage, retail, rental cars, parking, airline agreements, rental of property, any service provided on the airport.
So you have fixed income, fixed expenses, variable income and expenses. What are the areas that you could manipulate to try and maintain a healthy economic model.
So right now, when you look at airports that are doing okay financially, they have a diversification in their revenue base, not just within the aeronautical revenues, but into non-aeronautical.
An example
of that in San Francisco is there's a Grand Hyatt Hotel at the airport that just opened. While their business is certainly down, it is doing better than most hotels in the city. And so that is an example of one of the many ways airports develop other types of facilities to create additional revenue and also to provide some stability in the revenue. You see everything from other types of logistics facilities for cargo and ground handling. You see airports that, you look at like Dallas-Fort Worth, they have oil and gas leasing on the airport. So there are other lines of business that airports step into that are compatible with the operation of the airport, but that generate additional revenue. And it can't be more important than now, because airports across the country have seen such a dramatic drop in their aviation and airline revenues in particular. You know, we're very much a fixed overhead type of business. We're capital intensive. We have a lot of fixed costs, and you have to be able to pay for that somehow.
And I imagine it was palpable going through Houston the other day. They shrink wrapped half of their retail spaces, their gift shops and whatnot. They were just not only shuttered, they were wrapped up.
Certainly.
So that would be a huge hit for you guys as far as income, right?
It is. And when you look at the business to be had in the airport, that marketplace is contracted. With San Francisco is a great example of you know, an airport that their traffic is in the 10 to 15% of year prior. The larger airports have not been immune to everything that's happened here, and in some cases have been, depending on where they are, affected even more significantly. So, yeah, the retail, the food and beverage, everything has declined with the lack of passenger travel.
And then, like rental cars you touched on, a lot of airports, they take a fee.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
And so that's gone, right?
It has all moved together. You look at it at an airport like San Luis, though, and how we're diversified here, although we don't have a hotel or a business park or some of these other components that airports have to support their revenue, we do have a very strong general aviation operation here. So essentially everything that doesn't fly but the airlines, and that's business aviation, that's owner flown, small aircraft, corporate aircraft, folks that come in for flight training operations. And general aviation has been quite resilient through this crisis. Folks are flying their airplanes for both personal and business reasons, and that generates some revenue for the airport. Our activity levels are not much lower. That side of the industry has remained relatively strong.
But out front in the parking lot, that's a sobering view.
It is. And yeah. And it, you know, when you look at the business volume on this airport from airline operations, parking, all the associated revenue that comes with
that's
that.
That's a real important, valuable revenue stream for you, right?
Airports across the country, if you look at their revenue and you look at the importance of just parking revenue alone, it's critical to how they operate. And our parking revenue is down dramatically, like most airports right now.
A couple of years ago, you and I were talking about airport parking structure.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen for a while.
Not for a while, but you know, one of the challenges in this is that we've seen this massive drop, unlike anything the industry's ever seen at any point in its history. And yet, if you look at the long-term growth in aviation, it always comes back. This one's going to take a while. There's no question about it. But the fundamental need to move people and products across long distances efficiently will not go away. It may happen for different reasons. There may be a different paradigm to air travel as to when and why people travel, particularly business travelers in the near term. But the need to move people and products is as old as humanity. Yeah. You know, we used to do it with a cart and a horse, and now we do it with airplanes.
And there's been a palpable shift to freighters transporting goods around the world by aircraft.
Yeah, and the conversion of passenger aircraft to do just that, you know, flying empty but with belly cargo or other types of operations. Majority of the cargo that moves in and out of our region is by ground.
Right. In your new world in San Francisco, that's major, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Amazon Prime Air is in there now. There's a whole logistics operation that has grown because of this event and to replace, obviously, some of the passenger traffic.
One more little tidbit, your future world. I know you share the love of the museum, the Aviation Museum at the International Terminal at SFO. What a cool place, and it's kind of tucked away and hidden.
Absolutely, yeah. What a beautiful spot. It's a recreation of the interior of the original airport, Mills Airport, and really fantastic facility. You know, an iconic, world class museum, and really sets the standard in what airport aviation museums can be.
The thing I love, I have a weak spot for Pan Am and the China Clipper, and they have a great array of ephemera from the day.
From a unique time period in aviation, and San Francisco was certainly a big part of that, both at Treasure Island and then at the Seaplane Harbor there at the airport. Mm-hmm. So,
and before the war, as you know, Treasure Island was envisioned as being SFO.
Exactly. What a different world that would have created, for sure, to have it right in the middle of the bay.
Yeah, they would have had to infill the bay for about a mile for the runways. Kevin Booman, this is great. I'm going to come hunt you down at SFO. You can plan on it.
We'll always have a lot to talk about, Tom.
You got it. Kevin, if somebody wanted to learn more about your world here.
Our airport website is being updated frequently as changes are occurring, you know, COVID-related or other types of major announcements.
And the URL is?
Is slowairport.com.
That's easy.
Yeah, I think travel these days certainly isn't for everyone, but I have the highest confidence in the safety of the passenger and that the airlines are doing everything they can to ensure that level of safety. And I know it's an uncomfortable thought for people, but my feeling is that it's safe.
Yeah. Kevin Booman, thanks again.
All right, Tom, thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the San Luis Obispo County Airport.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. Our next story is part of Valley Public Radio's collaboration with the StoryCorps Personal History Project. This is a recorded conversation from February 2020 mobile tour in Fresno and Bakersfield. These are lifelong friends, 94-year-old Gary Sudama and 87-year-old Yutaka Yamamoto. They talk about the Japanese-American internment camps during World War II and how they adjusted to life afterward. Sudama begins.
My dad came over from Hiroshima when he was 16 years old, and he came to Stockton, California area, where there are a bunch of local farmers up there, and a lot of people from Hiroshima went to Stockton. During that time, he figured that if I'm going to get married, I don't want my wife working on a farm. So he came into the city of Stockton and opened up a grocery store. We were given a notice of 1 week to clean up our business. After a couple of days, he found a store man that would buy it on 60 cents on the dollar. Day before we had to leave, he came and gave my dad 15 cents on a dollar. And my dad had no way to get out of it, so he took it.
When Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, that day, December 7th, it turned, our lives took a different path. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, I noticed that on the telephone poles, the army, the soldiers were going around tacking up a memorandum. And on that it said that all persons of Japanese ancestry will have to vacate. My parents ran a laundry business in Chinatown. And after the notices were put up, it was about not more than 2-3 month notice.
No, 7 days.
7 days. The government would allow us only what we can carry into the camps. We were at Fresno Assembly Center from, I think, around May to August. And then we were told that we would be relocated to Jerome, Arkansas. At that time, the government issued a questionnaire to each family. It was two questions that each family had to, the family head had to answer. And one question was, would we prove our loyalty to the United States? And the other was, would you serve in the armed forces if asked? And my dad answered no to both of them.
But when the Korean War came out, they were shorthanded on manpower, so they reclassified me 1A and sent me to Denver for the physical exam. Well, while in Denver, this officer just looked at me and got the list and check, 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 check. You're 1A. No 4F, 1A. And I looked at him. He looked at me. I couldn't do anything about it, and I was drafted into the Korean War. And then when my time came, after 2 years of service, they shipped me home. And after I came home to Alamosa, Colorado, I packed up and left the family to come to Fresno, and I started to go to Fresno State. That's when I met Yutaka. I was working for the gas station, and he walked by the gas station quite often. And we've been good friends for 70 years. When I came to Fresno, my sister was in Reedley, and she says, Gary, we're going to introduce you to a girl. So they took me on a blind date. That's where I met Betty. And after 46 years of marriage, she got cancer. One day in July, it was a beautiful day. Betty and I was watching TV. And then out of a clear blue sky, Betty says, Gary, you know I'm going to die. I said, yes, you got terminal cancer. So she told me, after the funeral, don't stay home and watch that idiot tube. You got to go out and socialize. That's the best advice anybody gave me.
We've known each other since 1951. So when the war ended, the only thing I remember most vividly is coming back to Fresno. We couldn't walk around freely and feel comfortable. Never miss somebody would either drive by or walk by, and they would look at us and say, you dirty Jap. And that was a slang that I never forgot. The thing that shocked me was a lot of the public was not aware of the fact that we were put into camps. I hope nothing like that happens again to any nationality. Yeah.
That was a recorded conversation from StoryCorps' February 2020 mobile tour in Fresno and Bakersfield. Those were lifelong friends, 94-year-old Gary Sudama and 87-year-old Yutaka Yamamoto. Our last segment of Issues and Ideas today is Around Downtown. Host Bettina Swigger speaks with Matt Quaglino, fourth-generation resident, about the changes downtown San Luis Obispo has experienced over the years.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger with our monthly segment called Around Downtown. Joining me for our segment today is Matt Quaglino, a downtown property owner, a local community leader, and a person who has very deep roots in the city of San Luis Obispo, as well as the surrounding areas. So thanks for being here today, Matt.
Thank you for having me, Bettina. It's my pleasure.
Are you from the Central Coast? Did you grow up here?
I was born and raised here. Both my parents were born and raised here. Two of my grandparents were born and raised here. And I think it all started with my great-grandfather immigrating here from Italy and started at the Mainini Ranch out on Highway 1. And he was growing beans for the war. So that's where it all started. And then on my father's side, they immigrated from Italy as well in the early 1900s. And then they started a roofing company back in 1922.
Great. So your family has deep roots, both literally and figuratively, with plants in the ground and beams overhead. Did you ever leave the area? Have you spent your whole life here?
Spent my whole life here. I went to Mission Grammar School. And then about around the time that we got ready to go into the upper grades, they closed the high school. So we went to the public school system, which was great. And I went to the school, I would call it the School of Quaglino. My dad said, you're gonna come to work. And that's where it all started.
And you have children too, right?
I have two. I have a 35-year-old daughter with two kids who lives here in San Luis. And my son, Adam, he is 36 and he works in our company and lives in an apartment on our property.
Great. So you've got multiple generations living in San Luis Obispo, and your family's been here for how many generations? Four?
That would be four. And then my kids would be five.
Wow.
And my grandkids would be six.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, I've only lived in San Luis Obispo for, it'll be 10 years in January. So, but I got here as soon as I could, if that's any consolation.
Glad you came.
Thanks. Well, and it's been really fun getting to serve. In addition to my radio host, I'm also the CEO of Downtown SLO, the business association. And it's been so gratifying and fascinating and educational to learn about our downtown. So with your history, can you tell us a little bit about what downtown was like maybe when you were growing up?
Let me start a little bit sooner. I remember my father telling me that during the war, it was a steady line of cabs from downtown to Camp San Luis, bringing the soldiers into town to go to the bars and the restaurants and whatever else was going on there. And I think the guy that owned the cab company, if I remember, his last name was Singer or something like that. But that was a big part of it. And back then, he told me that downtown was mostly bars and restaurants. And then I think it kind of evolved into more retail. I remember when we had Woolworth downtown or the Five and Dime and things like that. I remember, you know, where Downtown Center is now, on the corner, there was Farley's Jr., which was a restaurant where everyone would go. We had an A&W with Car Hops up on Santa Rosa Street. It was a totally different place. You could get a hamburger at Ed's for 25 cents, and that's where Splash is now. So yeah, it was different. It was slow. I mean, I remember as a young boy, going downtown was no big deal. You hop on your bike and take a ride around town. I don't know if I would let, you know, kids that age do that these days for a lot of reasons.
So with that in mind, what are some of the changes that you've seen? Anyone who goes downtown now can see that we've kind of returned to that era of a lot of bars and restaurants.
I remember in high school, the big thing was to cruise downtown. And so it was just continuous loop down Hygera, back up Marsh, around and around. And it got to be, I guess, a problem. And so the city's solution to stop that was to close the streets. This was on Thursday nights. So they'd close Thursday nights and they're trying to make it like a downtown shopping night. But I think the whole thing started was trying to stop the cruising. And then from there, it evolved into the farmer's market, which was great. So, hey, the streets are closed. Let's do something with them. And they believe they came up with the idea of doing the farmer's market. And I think wasn't San Luis one of the first to do a farmer's market downtown?
Definitely one of the first and one of the only year-round farmer's markets, right. Especially yeah. A night market.
Yeah, so that happened. And then, you know, from there, downtown was just a place to go. I mean, you could go. I remember my family had an account at Green Brothers, a clothing store. So my dad would send us down there to get our clothes, especially if we're going to go to the prom. So go down to Green Brothers and get your whatever you're going to wear type thing. And you just would charge it. I mean, we used to charge at the grocery stores because there weren't any big grocery stores either way back then. They were all small corner markets. I remember going to Ellsworth Market and it was like a grocery store. And that's where we'd go do all your shopping. And then when the big grocery stores came in, all these smaller markets started closing out. There was another one on the corner of Mill and Santa Rosa, where there's a county office there now. But yeah, it was all small grocery stores. So yeah, it was slower time. And then the big stores started coming. I think the first one was called Purity. They're on Marsh, which would be where Mountaineer Sports is now, I think. And then downtown was full of retail stores. I mean, you could get a lot done, but that was way before the advent of online shopping, of course. And, you know, you needed it. We had a Penny's, we had a Sears, all the stores that you would think would never go away, which are now all gone, were here. And that's where you did all your shopping. Now, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when the bars and restaurants started reappearing. And so it's really nothing new. It was here before. It was just a cycle. And now we're cycling back into bars and restaurants, which really brings people downtown. I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with it, although it's kind of sad that we're losing a lot of the retail we have downtown. It'd be nice to somehow figure out how to get all that back.
Yeah, and going to the bars and restaurants for a moment, one of the really interesting things that came out during the shutdown as we first started to experience the pandemic was to see how some of the restaurants shifted and sort of became de facto bodegas and market bistros, right? Like, they were just doing takeout and delivery at that time, but they would put their wares that they ordered from a farmer. They'd have a little vegetable market and a deli case set up. And that was something that I thought, gosh, it'd be so neat if that stuck around as we move forward.
Yeah, you know, I believe that one of the silver linings, if you could call it that, that's going to come out of COVID is that we are all learning that we can do things differently, where before, you know, it wasn't even imaginable that we would have people dining in the street. That was something that I advocated for a very long time when I was on the downtown concept plan. I said, let's do this European dining thing. Let's build the platforms out on the street. Oh, that never caught anywhere. But, you know, it became a necessity during COVID. And I do it quite often. And it's enjoyable to go out and eat on the street. You see people walking by, you know, you get to say hi. You're out in the air. I'm hopeful, and I think it will become a permanent fixture in our downtown to get people out of the buildings and out into the streets.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between host Bettina Swigger and fourth-generation San Luis Obispo resident Matt Quaglino.
What has your experience been with your tenants who are restaurants? Have they benefited economically from the parklets and the new outdoor dining? Is it allowing them to break even?
That's a struggle for sure. I mean, this has been a struggle for a lot of people. I mean, we lost some, and, you know, those mostly the big nationals, you know, they just look at a spreadsheet and say, let's axe these 20 stores. And, you know, if you're on the list, you're done. Some of the smaller chains, you know, it was kind of a chore to get them to open back up, but we did what we could to help them. We said, you know, what can we do? How can we help you? And actually, for a lot of these restaurants, it may work out very well for them because they may be able to increase their seating capacity once they're able to open up 100% indoors, and if they can maintain the parklet outdoors, they're going to increase their seating capacity. So they will benefit from it. A very unfortunate way that it all came about, but you know, I think there will be some good that could come from it.
What are some other ideas that you've had over the years that maybe necessity being the mother of invention, maybe now would be a time to bring some of those up?
I think we're going to be seeing a lot of new innovative things. Now, one thing I just came across, I think Merida in Mexico, and it's a small town. It's supposed to be the safest city in Mexico. They pride themselves on that. But they closed the main streets downtown on Sunday to get everybody to come out. And there's kids riding their skateboards, and people are on skates, and people on bicycles. Everyone's, you know, milling around, visiting with their neighbors, eating out, shopping. I mean, that would be a wonderful thing to do. I mean, look how many people come out for farmers market. Now, farmers market is a little bit different because there's a lot of people crammed onto just Higuera Street. But if you could just kind of imagine it, maybe a portion of Marsh, Higuera, and Monterey that are closed that people could circulate around on, it would be nice. I mean, it just gets people out. Instead of driving through it in your car, get out and visit with people. You know, spend some money in the restaurants and the shops.
Definitely. And I think probably one thing that has not changed over the many years that you've seen downtown evolve is how walkable it is. It's a small footprint. It's got beautiful trees overhead. It's shady.
Yeah, I would say at least 4 to 5 days a week, I'm walking through downtown. I get up early in the morning at 6. When I'm up for it, I run a little bit, but I walk through down. I walk down Marsh, Higuera, Monterey, and you see a lot. And when you walk through the neighborhoods too, the housing neighborhoods, you see things you wouldn't see in a car. I mean, you notice things. I mean, there's some really cool houses we have here in town, and you don't notice those when you're going by at 30 miles an hour. And also too, when you're downtown, you run into people that you know. You know, it's nice to say hi.
Definitely. Yeah, this is a place where it's hard to meet a stranger, right?
Right.
Or even if you meet a stranger, they won't be one for long.
That's right. Exactly.
And they're probably connected to your family by at least like 3 different spokes, considering how connected you are. So what are some of the challenges that you see going forward? Let's say maybe 6 months to a year in the future, if you can look ahead that far.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of talk about we're not going to see the true impact of all this, all of what's been happening with COVID for 6 months to a year. When this whole thing started, everyone said, oh, this is going to be a 3-month thing. We're going to shut down for 3 months and everything's going to be rosy again. And that's not the case. We're into, for what, 9 months now? But I think the fallout is going to, we're not going to see the true impact of that until maybe middle of next year or so. And there's been a lot of changes. I mean, we have a lot of tenants, commercial type office tenants, that are learning that they don't need a big office anymore. And so we've had some that have said, when our lease is up, we're not renewing it. We're going to all work from home. Or we have others that have said, we don't need this much space. We're going to downsize, you know, our brick storefront, and we're going to have people working from home, or we're going to share the office. You know, you come in 2 days a week and you people come in 3 days a week. So there's going to be a change with that for sure. And I don't think we've seen all that's going to happen from that quite yet.
Yeah, we're hearing that from a lot of other downtowns around the country and the world too. In some ways, our downtown is a little bit protected from that because we don't have the towering skyscrapers, you know, full of office tenants. But some of the other major districts in large urban areas are really suffering because they're without the office buildings. There's no foot traffic to the restaurants and the shops below.
You know, like New York is a good example. In Manhattan, they have all those colleges in those cities and all the offices. They say that, you know, everyone would go outside for lunchtime and there'd be thousands of people going out to lunch. Well, that's not happening. There's no, they don't need the cabs driving people to get to places. So, yeah. You know, so we don't have that here, but, you know, our downtown, we might want to start getting a little bit more creative with what can go in. I mean, look at those 2 vacancies that we're going to have coming up where Ross and the fabric store is. I mean, those are big spaces, and I don't know what you're going to put in those. I mean, maybe a bowling alley, but, you know, they may have to get creative. I mean, I don't know if it's appropriate. There's a lot of talk about, you know, doing office on the ground floor. You know, I think that would be appropriate in some spaces because, yeah, maybe it's not retail, but, you know, if there's 150 people working in an office, they're all going to go out and have lunch. They're going to be downtown, And that's what we need, are more people downtown. And we need that with more housing downtown as well. It just need more people there relying on the services that are offered from a downtown, that and the downtown shops benefit from that.
So how does this experience that you've gone through over the last 9 months compare to the last economic recession?
You know, 08, that was a big lesson for a lot of people, especially, you know, property owners that were over-leveraged. They couldn't hang on. It was a difficult time, but we all got through it. You know, this is somewhat similar, but it's affected everyone. Where maybe in 08, it was more selective about who was really impacted by it. But it seems now that everyone's impacted by it. And for us, we have residential, we have just regular straight office, we have warehouse space, we've got retail space, we have food service space, we have medical space. And you know, who would have thought that something could happen that would affect everything? And that's where we're at. So there, no one was spared at all. So it's going to be like we have hit the reset switch or the reset button, and we're going to kind of build back up once we finally hit rock bottom. And I'm assuming we're close to that. I'm hoping that we're starting to come back out of this.
Well, is there anything else you want to add?
I love San Luis. I'm not going anywhere. I was born here. I mean, I can't imagine any other place I'd want to live. I mean, San Luis is the kind of place, and I'm sure you've heard this from others, that, you know, when we travel, we're always happy to come home, you know, and there's other people are living in places where they don't want to go home because they've gone to some place that's pretty unique, but we live in a very unique area. So we're very fortunate for that.
Definitely. Well, and we're fortunate to have compassionate people who are invested in multiple generations to make sure that our community can continue to be successful. So thank you very much for being on our program today, Matt Quaglino. Great. Thank you so much.
Hey, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
For Issues and Ideas, this has been Bettina Swigger with the segment called Around Downtown.
That was Bettina Swigger speaking to fourth-generation San Luis Obispo resident Matt Quaglino. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments at kcbx.org.